Welcome back to Against the Grain. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Today, I spoke with Stephanie Colo Manning, who is a chef and owner of Colo Kitchen, which offers consulting and cooking lessons for people who want to transition to a nutrient-dense whole foods diet. She also had colitis and is someone who had a relatively rapid response to diet and was able to maintain her remission without the use of medications, with confirmed healing by colonoscopy. We also have a very detailed discussion about implementing the SED, which I imagine would be very helpful to both those who are thinking about starting it and also those who are SED veterans. As a disclaimer, it is advisable that you discuss any dietary therapies with your physicians first. I have done many of the research studies regarding SCD for IBD, and so far the evidence is still considered weak in the form of case reports and case series. However, randomized controlled trials are being conducted now at other centers, so I'm hopeful in the future we will have stronger evidence to determine more details regarding the efficacy of the diet. You can also contact me in case you have any questions about this podcast or if you'd like to make an appointment to see me. My email is samir3@gmail.com. So today we have Stephanie Manning, who is someone I met at a conference. I attended the Specific Carbohydrate Diet Association conference. It was called SCD Rocks, and I had given a talk there about co-managing the SCD diet with medical therapy. And afterwards, Stephanie kindly came up to me and introduced herself, and we talked a little bit. And she actually runs a company called Colo Kitchen, where she offers consulting as well as I believe classes for cooking, for healthy eating. So yeah. Stephanie, thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So I was wondering, if can you take us through kind of your health challenges? I know you had ulcerative colitis, and kind of how that all started and what happened towards the beginning.
Sure, yeah. So my symptoms really began probably around 1980. I was around age 15. And, you know, back then I never mentioned anything to my parents. And around 1985, 1986, when I was in engineering school, my symptoms started, you know, really getting worse. I started to get really worried. So I finally told my mom about it, and then I had a bunch of testing done and was given the original diagnosis back in like January of 1987 of regional ileitis. So it was not yet inflammatory bowel disease, but I remember the doctor talking about Crohn's disease, and he prescribed sulfasalazine and bland foods. So, you know, kind of like continued along, and, you know, right when I graduated college in 1987, I experienced some very severe abdominal pain. I remember lying on the floor all night, like in a fetal position. And, you know, I was young and stupid, so I didn't even ask for help that night. I waited until morning. But then I got admitted to the, I went to the emergency room, and I spent a week in the hospital, and they gave me IV prednisone and sent me home with a prescription of prednisone and sulfasalazine and instructions to avoid nuts, seeds, fiber, and eat bland foods. So I actually had
just one quick question about that. So at this point, were they only saying it was involving the small intestine, like that?
Yeah.
The ileum?
Okay. Yeah, it was just the terminal ileum. So I guess the very end of the ileum, and it was labeled regional ileitis at that point.
So it's interesting they prescribed you sulfasalazine, which, you know, I know this was many years ago, so the understanding of these diseases was not as good back then as it is now. But sulfasalazine is a medicine that only has an effect in the colon.
Okay.
There's no effect on the ileum at all. And even now we know that these mesalamine medications, including sulfasalazine, they're not very good overall in treating Crohn's. We do use them sometimes when the inflammation appears very superficial and it kind of looks like ulcerative colitis, even though the pathology may say Crohn's. So sometimes there are certain doctors that use that, but definitely back then that was probably not the right medicine. But even back then, a lot of what we have available today wasn't available. So
Right. Yeah. And, you know, there was very little discussion about it. I don't think that much was known. And, you know, we certainly had never heard of it. So
right.
Didn't have access to the internet at that time. So
sure.
We just kind of did what we were told. So, so then over the next 20 years, you know, flares came and went. And at first it seemed to be like every 7 years. And then it was like every 4 years, every 2 years. And they were definitely getting more frequent and more severe. By 1994, I had a new diagnosis of ulcerative colitis. And just looking back on my records, looked like that involved about 15 centimeters of the colon. And then, you know, kind of bounced back and forth. So in 2007, it seemed to be limited to moderate ulcerative proctitis. And, you know, at that point I was given other various prescriptions just throughout this whole time, you know, whether it be Asacol or Canasa or Roasa or prednisone. And, you know, the latter two, Roasa and prednisone, seemed to be the ones that helped me the most throughout that 20-year span. And, you know, again, I was always just told to, well, try to avoid nuts and seeds and fiber and eat bland, but otherwise diet didn't really matter. So in 2009, then, I developed Lyme disease, and I was also happening to have another flare. But I actually think the two were connected, because after treating the Lyme with a lot of antibiotics, the flare actually seemed to resolve for a while. But then in 2012, I had another big flare, and that one wouldn't resolve. So now, you know, it seemed to be involving about 40 centimeters of the sigmoid colon, and the Roasa wasn't touching it. The prednisone was maybe helping a little bit, but, you know, I tapered off, and the flare came bouncing right back. And, you know, I actually tried 3 consecutive rounds of prednisone, so I was on it for probably about, I'm guessing, 9 months, and that wasn't helping. So I was also being given a prescription for Ativan, because, which is an anti-anxiety medication, because, you know, my doctor was thinking that the stress was making it all worse, and she was probably right. And I was also taking sleeping pills, you know, until my sister, who's a nurse, told me I can't take them together. So there were some days, you know, it was really bad. I couldn't even get out of bed some days to get my children at the bus stop. So, you know, I felt pretty helpless. And so my GI told me that the next step would be to take Remicade. And, you know, she explained that it was an immune suppressing IV infusion that I'd probably have to take, you know, every month for the rest of my life. And, you know, the idea of suppressing my immune system really scared me. I had 2 young kids in elementary school, and, you know, I didn't know what kind of infections they could possibly bring home from school.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, a friend suggested that I see a doctor with a different approach, an integrative medicine approach. So I just thought, you know, what do I have to lose? And, you know, that's really when everything started changing for me.
So a couple points on some of the things you mentioned. So you said the Lyme disease diagnosis, you felt like it may have been related to your flaring.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not really aware of an association between the two, but I can see how antibiotics potentially could have helped, because we do use them sometimes, in particularly in Crohn's disease, and that affects the rectum, and sometimes when there's perianal disease, antibiotics can help Crohn's. Now, your diagnosis, it seemed like initially was Crohn's because the ileum was involved, but then mm-hmm. later on they just saw that the colon was involved. I still think overall the diagnosis probably was still Crohn's, because as you know, Crohn's can affect any part of the bowels. At different mm-hmm. points of time, you'll see different parts being involved. So I think overall it was probably still Crohn's, and that does go along with your response to antibiotics, because overall, antibiotics don't really work that well for ulcerative colitis compared to Crohn's. And then,
yeah, that's interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And what I've observed, you know, I've also studied, I've done a large case series on the SCD with patients with IBD, and I really searched far and wide for people who did well on the diet, and I found that people who had Crohn's colitis actually did the best. Because we only found just a few patients with ulcerative colitis who were, like, in remission on the SCD without any medication. But far more people had Crohn's. So I wonder, you know, a lot of the people who say that they have ulcerative colitis that responded to the diet, maybe some of them actually had Crohn's. And it's the distinction, it may be important as far as figuring out who's more likely to respond and who isn't. But there are definitely people with ulcerative colitis who I've met personally who've done well on the diet as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was bouncing back and forth, and I mean, I don't think I've ever had any other, you know, testing to reflect the status of the small intestine.
Okay.
After that initial point, so it's quite possible. I don't know. The other thing that I will mention about maybe the possible connection between Lyme and the inflammatory bowel disease. I kind of feel like, you know, maybe one of the doctors explained it to me this way that, you know, maybe the impact that the Lyme was having on my body and my immune system, you know, might have just made me more susceptible to kind of like giving in to, you know, to the symptoms.
So
and not being able to stand up to that.
Do you live in an area that's like mm-hmm. Lyme is endemic? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I live in Northern Virginia, so it's really all over the place here. A lot of people have been talking about it ever since we've been here, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because there is this movement, particularly amongst people who are in integrative medicine or kind of the, not the conventional Western medicine, but other health practitioners and other disciplines are now diagnosing Lyme. And there's been an outcry as far as, are these legitimate mm-hmm. diagnoses? Because I know the testing can be a little bit difficult to interpret because there's multiple tests and sometimes one will be positive, one will be negative.
Yeah,
and it's like,
exactly.
I think for you, it was a true diagnosis and related to a tick bite, which is how you get these.
You know, it was one of these things that at like Quest Diagnostics, it came back negative, but then at like Igenix, it came back positive. So, you know, really depending on what criteria you're looking at. So
okay.
Who really knows? You know, I guess it remains to be seen.
Right,
so,
right.
But it's an interesting piece.
Okay, sorry. Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
No. Yeah, so then, so once I saw the integrative doctor, you know, she was a conventional MD for decades. So, she kind of came from that world. And at some point, she shifted into the integrative medicine realm. So integrative medicine practitioners, you know, they can still write prescriptions, but they also rely very heavily on functional medicine. So, you know, they do a lot of assessments and, you know, treatments, you know, that are of a functional nature, that are a major part of their toolbox. So, you know, she spent a full hour with me asking me all kinds of questions about my life that I had never been asked before. You know, we discussed that, you know, maybe the Lyme disease could be back and causing this flare again. Again, this is 2012. But we decided that, you know, before we attack the Lyme again, that, you know, she suggested doing a low inflammation diet. So at that point, I eliminated just 5 foods, and so gluten, dairy, corn, soy, and sugar, and then alcohol and caffeine. And then she gave me a medical food, which was a powder loaded with just tons of easily digestible nutrients, and a really good fish oil and some herbs to help me with the sleep and the stress. And, you know, right away my symptoms started fading, and within 30 days they were completely gone. So it was like really mind-blowing to me. At the same time, she did adrenal and stool testing, and that testing came back, and that's when she added a good probiotic and a DHEA supplement and digestive enzymes and, you know, another herb. So, I mean, it was pretty amazing to me at that time, and I felt great. And that went on, you know, for a few months, but then now that that was under control, we decided it was time to readdress the Lyme. So I started working with my Lyme specialist again. It did look like the testing, you know, showed that it might be back. So I started up again on heavy antibiotics, which was, you know, Alinia, Mepron, Bioxin, Bactrim, and Flagyl for weeks, you know, or even months. And at the same time, you know, we found out that I had the MTHFR gene mutation. And then within 3 months of taking these antibiotics, you know, and by now I was probably cheating on the diet too, I started flaring again. So I think that the antibiotics really disrupted the gut bacteria and just kind of restarted the inflammation, and the cheating didn't help either. So mm-hmm. I stopped all the antibiotics at that point at the advice of the both doctors. And for the next 2 months, I just tried going strict on the low inflammation diet again. And I started up on the Virwasa and the Asacol again. And things were improving, but not enough. Like, I wasn't back to where I was. And I just decided, you know, it was time to do something else. Someone had opened my eyes to the SCD. And so by May of 2013, you know, I listened to Natasha Campbell McBride, who explained, you know, just the whole thing about gut bacteria and, you know, how it can be, you know, your gut lining can really just, it turns over so rapidly, and, you know, it really made me hopeful that I can make some changes. So I considered either the GAPS or the SCD. You know, all of it just made so much sense to me once it was spelled out. And I was just super motivated because I was just tired of being sick and I was just ready to do anything. And I'd already proven to myself that diet was really important. So, you know, I just decided to do the SCD rather than the GAPS at that time, just because SCD was just more focused on ulcerative colitis. And it seemed like there was a pretty good online email support group. So I just decided to start that. And I started that on May 11th, 2013. And, you know, it was pretty interesting. It was, I learned a lot. I did have you know, kind of a culinary background before starting SCD.
Can you tell us about that? What kind of background did you have?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always loved cooking. I grew up in an Italian family. So like there was always food on the, you know, going on in the kitchen. And I've always enjoyed taking cooking classes over the years, and I experimented with, you know, lots of different things from scratch, throwing big dinner parties, and, you know, started a catering business. So I was really lucky that I knew my way around the kitchen. And so I always felt very lucky going into the SCD with these skills. But I would just say to anybody, you know, starting out, that cooking is not rocket science. It just takes following a recipe, getting organized, and setting your intention. You know, you do have to let go of other things in your life that are less important. And, you know, I just kind of feel this way even for people who are healthy. I think that, you know, real food has taken a backseat to so many other things. And I just think that it needs to be a priority for everyone, just like showering and brushing our teeth and, you know, doing our nails. We have to take care of ourselves in this way, too. You know, it's not always easy at first, yeah, and especially if you're not feeling well, but
it is an important part of the SCD, is the whole issue with starting it, the whole, just the process of it. I almost liken it to quitting smoking when I, you know, when I see patients who have, because I feel like being on a westernized diet full of processed foods, in order to quit that, it's a big deal. Now, when I started the SCD, about 10 years ago, I distinctly remember the last time I ate in a restaurant, and I remember thinking, this is probably the last time I'm going to be able to eat this, but I remember the exact Chinese restaurant. I ate some sort of breaded chicken, fried chicken dish, and with some, like, fried rice, but that was the last thing I ate, and then I just quit, like, cold turkey, and just started the SCD right that day, but... And, you know, over time, it's become more just second nature. But I see patients now, and I've seen several so far now that I've been working at Rush University in Chicago. And I see people who are just newly diagnosed, right? Just a complete new diagnosis. And I wonder, and I go back to what I went through and thinking about what would be the ideal way to implement this. And a lot of these patients are relatively sick and do need some medical support initially just to stabilize them. But my approach is saying, you know, let's get you on the right medication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to talk about diet when you see me in clinic. I do want to start diet as soon as possible, but it can be very overwhelming, especially number one, when you get a new diagnosis, you don't know anything about it. You're likely going to get on the internet, start reading about it. And then number two, now you have you're in the hospital most of the time. And even if we say, oh, start this diet now, you can't really do it in the hospital. You're kind of forced to eat what the hospital is giving you.
Right.
And then number three, you got these kind of medications being discussed. Now, around the time you were diagnosed, it was in the 80s, right? 80s, 90s.
Right.
And
right.
At that point, there weren't that many medications available.
Right.
And I've seen, even at the conference we went to, a lot of the people there have been on the diet for several years, and they kind of got on the diet before these medications were available. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I gave that lecture talking about how do we put this diet in the context of all the medicines we have available right now, and how do we, like, optimally use it. But that's kind of what leads me, like, there's a lot to think about when you're first diagnosed. And then to put the SCD, which has so many layers of complexity to it,
it does, yeah.
On top of it, like, you just need to take a step back. And also diet, you know, the reason I wanted to speak with you, one of the main reasons is you were a relatively rapid responder. You got pretty good results relatively quickly, but in my experience, there's a lot of people who it takes longer. Diet is not, for most people, something that works very quickly, and it takes on the order of months to perhaps years to get the optimal effect. So as far as delaying it a couple weeks, as far as starting and also just the whole process of getting prepared, right? Getting all the equipment, the yogurt maker. A lot of people don't have kitchens that are equipped to actually implement this diet. So that takes time too. So it's just something to keep in mind.
And also, I'm not even so sure, like, jumping into it, you know, or doing the intro diet or, you know, and doing it full tilt on day one is for everyone. Because I think that, you know, just like when you take your dog to the vet and you're transitioning their diet, you know, they always say transition it slowly because, you know, things need to adapt. So I think we should be doing that too, because I think it's a big shock to the body to change everything overnight. I mean, your gut bacteria changes drastically, you know, really within a matter of, I think, I don't know, 24 to 48 hours. So, you know, you could see that it can really kind of upset the apple cart. So, I mean, when I talk to people about it, I suggest to them that they sort of start by eliminating, you know, some of the, you know, the more instigating type foods first and sort of back their way into it. And then, you know, after their body has started becoming a little bit adjusted to it, then maybe go, you know, full tilt. I don't know, like, because I felt like for me, like you mentioned, I responded quickly. And I have to say, I responded very quickly, you know, to that, those first, you know, five items that I removed. But, you know, once I actually started the SCD in 2013, it was really, you know, two steps forward and one step back for a couple of months. And I mean, I remember crying, you know, because I was starting to think this whole thing was crazy. You know, maybe I had something more serious going on and, you know, maybe I should just stop this diet. I was ready to throw in the towel. You know, my husband just said, Stephanie, this is the healthiest you've ever eaten in your entire life. Just give it more time. So, you know, by the 2 or 3 month mark, I started really seeing some exponential improvement. And, you know, I started even putting smiley faces in my food journal and seeing, you know, some perfect type fours and type fives. And, you know, but then in addition to that, I noticed my energy was really improving. I started sleeping better. Any like anxiety or depression I had previously had was now gone. I lost weight, you know, I was able to exercise again. So, and then I really didn't feel any more of the Lyme disease symptoms. I didn't feel any, you know, joint stiffness. It seemed to combat that as well. So, you know, by the 3 month mark, I was really eating some really good meals and, you know, and I just feel that it launched my health, you know, way beyond my expectations. I mean, I didn't cheat. There was no way I was going to undo any of that hard work. And, you know, the science of it just kept me in the game. And, you know, I just kept a little note on my food journal. And, you know, I still think about it. The note is the body is a miraculous self-healing machine. And when we institute excellent nutrition, the body's natural tendency to heal takes over. So I just kind of kept going back to that. But, you know, I do remember feeling that it was definitely, you know, at times two steps forward, one step back.
Right.
So, yeah, it's pretty funny.
That's one of the reasons, you know, I when I see patients, I really individualize things based on what I see on the scope, labs, how they're feeling. Now, there's some people who have very severe disease that I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm a proponent of using medication and diet together, especially early on, and if you have severe disease, is that I feel like the medication can kind of smooths out that roller coaster you have that first year. Because in reality, I think a lot of people end up on this diet on prednisone nowadays because they're on prednisone and then, you know, your GI recommends a medication like Remicade or another biologic. And it's scary to have to go on an infusion or get injections. So then people start investigating alternatives. Ultimately, the SCD comes up, and then they go on SCD, and they think, oh, then maybe I can avoid going on this biologic. I'll go on this SCD, and then I'll taper the steroids. But what I've noticed is that as you taper the steroids, things may start to get rocky because ultimately the steroids are probably what led to some of your improvement early on, and then diet may take longer, and then you start to taper and you feel worse, have to go back up on steroids, and then the question of biologic comes back up. So it's a very confusing time. So my approach is just get people better initially. Mm-hmm. Like, try to attack the inflammation every angle that you can, and then later on we'll talk about what we need to continue, you know, long term and how. But the most important thing for me initially is just getting people to feel better.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I think, you know, getting the inflammation down is key. That's like primary. But, and I think, you know, that's a great, you know, short-term solution. And then a long-term, you know, play is just, let's look at how you're going to maintain this and possibly just taper off that medication. I mean, that would be the ideal goal. So
right.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, and in my talk, which hopefully they posted online, apparently they're supposed to, all the talks at the conference, they're going to edit and post eventually, I think sometime in the winter. But one of the things I mentioned was that, you know, some medications are easier to do that than others. Like the biologics, they tend to be a little bit harder. You have to think pretty carefully before you stop that in people. And there's certain parameters that may suggest it may be okay. But that's also a very controversial area within gastroenterology. There's many gastroenterologists who just say, continue it if you're not having any adverse reactions or side effects, because if you stop it, you may form antibodies, and then restarting it you may be burning a bridge with that mm-hmm. medicine.
Right, you wouldn't be able to respond to it later potentially.
But the reality is, most people, when you stop a biologic and restart it within a reasonable amount of time, most people regain response. So that fear that was there in the past may not be justified.
Mm-hmm.
But that's getting a little bit off topic. So back to what you were saying. So you started the SCD, and then were you aware of any other diets? Because there's many other diets for IBD. I know you said you were looking at GAPS and SCD, but were you aware of like the Maker's diet?
No, not at that time. I mean, basically what I had heard from, I hadn't really heard of any other diets at that time. What I'd heard from Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride sold me, you know, and I just looked at the two of them. They seemed very similar. They were both gut healing protocols. And I said, you know, which one do I have the better chance of staying on? And I said, well, there's a support group with this one. Let me go for it. So it wasn't until later that I discovered that there were other diets too.
Okay. So then what happened with the SCD? You said you had a few steps back, a few steps forward over the first year. And then after that, you feel like you pretty much stabilized and were feeling pretty well after?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I might have had like some small flares here and there. I think I kind of feel like at some point I was eating too many peanuts. You know, that might have thrown me into a little flare. At some point, I did go back to the integrative medicine doctor, and she, you know, I had some additional adrenal testing done, and so she had put me back on DHEA, and that seemed to help stabilize things. So it was really only like once or twice, and it wasn't as bad, you know, as it had been previously. But then after that, you know, I think by 2000, maybe 2015, you know, maybe even earlier, I mean, probably after 2 years or so, you know, I didn't have any more flares. So I don't think I've had a flare for over 3 years now.
And this is
knock on wood.
Without any help
Nothing.
With pharmaceutical medications,
correct? Right,
okay.
Right. So in fact, yeah, so I went back to my GI, you know, and I was telling her that I felt great, and I told her all about the SCD, and, you know, she mentioned that there was one patient who had improved on the SCD, but then their symptoms came back, and, you know, just overall she wasn't very, very supportive. She wanted me to get another colonoscopy, and I kind of held off on that because I just didn't want to drink the solution. I didn't want to undo all my hard work, but I finally did do the colonoscopy in 2016. Yeah, so I was over 3 years on the SCD at that point. And afterwards, when I woke up, she just said, there's absolutely no signs of ulcerative colitis. There's only some scarring from previous activity. And then the most wonderful words that she said to me were, you're doing this without medication? Amazing. Amazing. She said it twice. And then she said that I didn't have to come back for 5 years. So I was just like, wow.
So
that was amazing to me.
That is amazing. And I wanted to make a few comments about your interaction with your GI. Because you know, I've been on both sides of the curtain. I know how GIs think, and I know how patients think. So one of the things that doesn't make sense, and I've noticed this working with my colleagues, is that a doctor may have a handful of patients who've tried this diet, and they may have a few people who didn't respond, maybe a few people who partially responded, and maybe some that completely responded. But, and then based on that limited experience, they'll tell everybody, oh yeah, it probably doesn't work, or diet doesn't have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. But I challenge those doctors to also think about their patients who have been on Remicade, mm-hmm. who have been on Entyvio, who've been on these biologic medicines, or mm-hmm. even Imuran, any of these medications, and they have, I guarantee you, they have many, many more patients who've been on just those without diet. And how many of them have failed?
That's such a good point.
Right? But are you telling subsequent patients that Remicade doesn't work? Because I saw, you know, like I've had, you know, probably hundreds of patients who didn't respond or lost response. I understand that there's randomized controlled trials, very strong evidence to show it does work, and that it's superior to placebo, and we don't have that yet for the SCD. But to use the argument that, first of all, the research hasn't been done, you've just seen a few patients who've tried it, maybe they didn't have success with it, and based on that, you're going to say it doesn't work. The more appropriate answer should be either I don't know, because we haven't studied it yet, mm-hmm. Or you know, you can try it because there isn't much of a downside to it, and maybe it'll help you because there's anecdotal success for other people. But to say that it doesn't work based on no evidence and some anecdotal experience and a few patients possibly who maybe didn't even do it right, and maybe the people who did do it aren't actually following up with you anymore because they don't need to see you.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how much more time it's going to require because, I mean, studies are coming out. More and more studies are being done. I mean, gut microbiome is becoming a household word. I mean, we're seeing ads that talk about it and, you know, like just things on TV and in the paper and magazines. So, I mean, it can't be that much longer. I mean, I have to think that within, I don't know, 5 years or so that maybe more and more, you know, GIs might be taking it more seriously. And, you know, but it is very much a grassroots effort. And I think you had made the comment that after you're feeling better, it's really important to go back to your GI and tell them and show them because otherwise, you know, they may not see it.
Right, right. Yeah, and I really do believe there is this thought, this concept or belief in medicine amongst physicians that if they don't understand things as well as the patient does, they kind of feel threatened. Like, mm-hmm. this diet ultimately was actually created by a physician, you know, Dr. Sidney Haas back in the, you know, early 1900s. But, and then it kind of lost its way because it was initially developed for celiac disease. Then the gluten-free diet kind of took over. But then that same physician started using it for inflammatory bowel disease and has success. And then it was almost taken over by Elaine Gottschall, and now kind of patients have kind of taken over the reign of this. So, mm-hmm. so doctors, I feel like there's this, they want to come up with things on their own. And then if something already exists that patients kind of already have a mastery of, I feel like that motivation to prove that it works isn't there because they didn't come up with it, which is sad.
Not invented here.
Right.
Syndrome.
Exactly. Yeah. And then even if they find that it works, it's like they can't, there's no way they're going to know how to implement it better than we can, than people who are already on it, who are on these message boards, who've over the years troubleshot the diet and have figured out how it works for each person. So in that sense, even if they prove that it's right, the only thing they're going to say is, yeah, read this book or go on this message board because they're not going to know.
Right, and if they had maybe somebody on staff that could help hold their hand through it, you know, that would make it a lot easier for the patients. But I think they also might be driven by, you know, the patients coming in with an expectation, you know, looking for the magic pill and just, you know, looking for the easy way out. And, you know, we've all been conditioned to think that way. So,
right.
you know, that might just kind of take away from the motivation as well.
Right. So that's great. Your colonoscopy showed that you had healing. So that's the ultimate proof. And that was another thing I talked about in my presentation, is this concept of N equals one medicine, right? Like, mm-hmm. clearly this worked for you, right? Yeah. I mean, right. you weren't on anything else. You did diet right. and you improved and your colon was healed. Some people may claim it's just spontaneous remission or placebo effect, but placebo effects don't tend to cause physiologic, like real changes as far as looking in with the scope. Like, but placebos can improve pain, can improve symptoms. That's why the real test of if this was working was the scope, and looks like right. you did heal. So
yeah, and you know I held off on it, like I said, but ultimately I wanted to prove that to myself too. I wanted to see it in black and white, you know,
right.
like I needed to prove it to myself too. So yeah, I was glad that I did it.
So a couple questions about the diet itself. Now, did you, when you started, did you do the stages? Did you do the starter diet, or did you just jump into the full thing?
Yeah, no, I did the intro diet. And, you know, like I said, I'm not sure I would do it that way again, because, you know, kind of it really shook things up for me at first. I did the intro diet. I started with, you know, broth, chicken, beef, and eggs, you know, and then I added one food at a time every couple of days. And all my veggies were peeled and seeded and pureed. And, you know, I remember taking, you know, a bunch of green beans that were seeded, you know, and cooked mushy, you know, into a restaurant with me. And, mm-hmm. you know, everyone was looking at me like, what? But, you know, it's kind of what I had to do. And I just kept looking forward. And, you know, the yogurt, I was doing a little bit of that at first. I wasn't really sure how that was sitting with me. So, you know, I held off on it, but then I eventually tolerated it.
Okay. Yeah, I had a similar story. You know, as far as the yogurt is concerned, I ate it for a while, and then I started to suspect I was not tolerating it. Mm-hmm. Then I tried making it with goat milk, and that seemed to sit better with me, but then the taste was a little bit off-putting, the goat
right.
milk. So then I just kind of stopped it altogether and replaced it with more kimchi, which mm-hmm. I was doing for a while. And then recently I just decided, you know, I'm going to try the yogurt again. This is after years of stopping it. Mm-hmm. And this time I used milk. Now they sell grass-fed milk. Mm-hmm. The cows are grass-fed and it's organic. And that wasn't mm-hmm. available before when I was making the yogurt. And now I tolerate it fine.
It's just interesting.
Yeah.
Right. And then there's also this difference between the A1 and the A2 casein. Right, the difference between the Jersey and the Holstein cows, and how, you know, one is more easily tolerated than the other. So, or the raw milk, and you know, but I never really went there because, you know, eventually I did start tolerating it. Okay. So I just use organic whole milk.
Okay.
You know, and I do it according to, you know, what I learned through the SCD group. Mm-hmm. You know, heat it up to make sure that you're killing off any rogue bacteria, and then, you know, cool it, and then mix in the yogurt starter. So the GI ProHealth is the one that I use. And, you know, I called them up one day just to find out how much probiotic that actually yields. And they had told me that it would yield about 40 to 45 billion organisms per 7-ounce serving. So, you know, that's pretty good. That's therapeutic doses. So,
okay. And yeah. Do you use the Yogurt May?
Yeah, I do. Yep, I use that yogurt maker, but I actually attach a dimmer switch to it because,
yeah.
you know, it runs a little too high. So, you know, yeah, I crank it up at first, but then once it reaches that magic window between 100 and 110 degrees, then I just notch it down to, you know, have like a little permanent marker line to where, you know, where it reaches that temperature. And then at that point, then I start timing it for 24 hours. And, you know, it's really delicious. I mean, I always have people try it and people are like, oh, I don't like yogurt. Oh, I hate yogurt. And then they try it and they're like, wow, this one's really good. This is good. It's got a good flavor.
Yeah.
That particular starter.
So do you do the 6-hour thing? Because this whole concept with the dimmer switch is not in the book. It's okay. really not seen in like the standard literature on SCD, but I also found this tip with using a dimmer switch just on some website, but I think you're supposed to keep it at full power for 6 hours and then go to half power?
Is that... it varies. It depends on how low I let the milk cool down to, you know, how much time has passed.
Okay.
So that's one factor. And then another factor is, you know, how cold it is. And, you know, it's sitting on my granite countertop. So maybe, you know, some days are going to be cooler than others. So I just kind of go in there and test the temperature every couple of hours. And when it reaches that point, then I lower it. But, you know, for me, it generally seems to be around maybe after four hours of the initial fermentation. So I guess it just depends on the situation.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder, you know, sometimes when you follow the SCD, you start to think, like, is some of this actually necessary? Or is this, like, this temperature range, like, what is that based on? It's just based on a sentence in the book that says
that. Right.
Like, has that really been... Like, why is it that I guess if it goes higher, the thought is you're killing some of the bacteria, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the optimal range of, you know, the bacteria reproducing. And if it's too low, right, then it's just... Because if you take that batch and you put it in the refrigerator, then it slows down the fermentation process. So the same holds true. So it's just really the optimal range for the bacteria to produce.
Okay.
And if you go too long, then you just run out of lactose in the milk, and then... the bacteria have nothing left to feed on. So again, comes back, the science of it is really interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so are there any foods that you can tolerate outside the SCD now, or are you still strictly on it?
Yeah, so, you know, I was very, very strict for the first 2 or 3 years. I didn't deviate at all, you know, to my knowledge. But then after 2 or 3 years, you know, I thought that I had been in remission long enough, and I started reintroducing, you know, a few non-SCD foods, but, you know, things that I considered real food. So, you know, maybe some rice, some sweet potatoes, some potatoes, and then just to kind of experiment a little bit with cocoa powder and maple syrup, pure maple syrup. And, you know, so I tolerate those very well. I haven't had any problems with them. When I eat out, I still order very carefully. So I always view the menu as an ingredients list. So, you know, I don't look at the descriptions of how the menu items are presented. I just, you know, go in for the kill. I look for the actual ingredients that are used there. So then I just ask them to prepare something special for me, you know, from scratch. And I don't worry that much anymore about if they make a mistake or if there are hidden ingredients. I used to, but not at this point. Sometimes I'll even have some potato chips, you know, but I'll make sure they're made with avocado oil, but I try not to do that because I know it's a slippery slope. And I have to keep myself in check. So, you know, I'm still in remission. It's been, you know, I've been doing SCD or very close to SCD for 5 years, and, you know, I want to be safe, and, you know, I do, I respect food, and I feel like my body's done so much for me. I want to be loyal to it. So I try not to push my boundaries too far.
Give us your top three places you like to eat out.
You know, like some of the good Mexican restaurants, like, I don't know, like an Uncle Julio's or something, you can usually get some pretty clean food. So I'll order fajitas without the shell, and I'll ask them to use clean meat that hasn't been marinated.
Okay.
So I'll always ask for it with just, you know, olive oil, salt and pepper, or shrimp. And you know, it's peppers and onions. It's just sauteing them cleanly, and avocado, you know, I'll ask questions, but I usually do pretty well there. I love to eat at a steak restaurant, and I just make sure that they don't put on any kind of seasoning mix. I just ask for, again, you know, salt and pepper only. That's okay. Very easy for them to do, you know, with some veggies on the side. Often it's just very simple to ask for, you know, just either sautéed or broiled or steamed veggies on the side. So, you know, I try to stick to those kinds of places. I try not to go to, you know, the chain restaurants, because I don't think they get it as much, and they have, you know, younger, less experienced servers, and you know, it just kind of gets too, I don't know, a little too scary there.
Right. Have you had any success going to, because there's certain restaurants or types of restaurants I know I'm going to have no chance at, and I haven't been to a Chinese restaurant in like a decade. Like that.
No,
just,
nor have I.
Although I have gone to Benihana, those Japanese places where they cook in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually doable because you see them cook in front of you, and you can actually request don't put any soy sauce in the food. And doing that, you're you're fine for the most part. And also sushi restaurants, I get sashimi pretty often, actually. That that tends to work. Doesn't tend to be too filling, though.
I mean, the other thing I really like is going to, like, a fish restaurant. We have something near us called the Fish Shack, which I love going to. And, you know, it's so easy to get just a clean piece of fish with, again, you know, olive oil, salt, and pepper, or even ask them to blacken it with, you know, a few spices, and then just put it on top of a nice big salad, you know, again, drawing from the ingredients that I see on the menu.
Okay.
So those are good choices, I think.
Yeah, I do feel like some, at restaurants, there's certain types of meats that tend to be pre-marinated and some don't. And seafood tends to be one that's not. Like, you can usually get a piece of fish that's just simply grilled. And many times they have that on the menu. But I feel like chicken is a problem one. I've tried to order chicken at multiple places and saying, like, oh, is it pre-marinated? Or I give them my card that has, I have this like laminated card that has all the stuff that I don't want in my food. And pretty much 99% of the time, if it's a chicken thing, they'll come back, chicken dish, they'll come back and say, hey, this has something in it that I can't have, or some pre-marinade. So I've pretty much given up on chicken in restaurants.
Well, yeah, so I found the same thing. Sometimes, you know, if you ask, do you have a clean piece that hasn't been touched yet, you know, sometimes they do. So I, now and then I do have good luck with that. With the beef, it seems a little easier unless it's one of these tougher cuts, like if it's a flank steak or if it's like a hanger steak, you can pretty much bet that those are going to be marinated. But if it's, you know, a filet or, you know, a New York strip or something like that, probably not, but they might often put a seasoning mix, like a house seasoning mix on it. So you have to ask about that. And then shrimp, you know, they always seem to have fresh as well. And like you said, seafood.
Okay. What about traveling? Have you had issues with that? I always get a little bit nervous about traveling, especially if you're traveling, like if you're traveling with people who know about your situation and know about your diet, it's not too bad, but going with a group of people who kind of want to have their own agenda as far as where they want to eat can be a difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, I'll be sure to eat something beforehand. You know, if I don't have any say over where we're going and someone wants to go to an Italian restaurant, I'll be like, all right, maybe I'll go. But I'll definitely eat dinner before I leave, or I'll bring something with me and eat it while I'm traveling. And then maybe when I get there, if I feel safe about it, I'll order a very simple salad and I'll just say I already ate. And, you know, you don't always have to go into it. But, you know, most of the time it might come up, you know, and they'll be like, oh, you eat so healthy, you know, or something like that. And it's kind of an opportunity to, you know, briefly explain why. And then 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, wow, my brother has that, or, you know, and it's like an opportunity to plant the seeds. So.
Right.
Yeah, if possible.
And I'm sure you, do you sometimes eat just to make other people comfortable? It's like you're not actually hungry, but you kind of want to avoid that situation where like, oh, I feel bad you're not eating. Or it's just, I've gone to a few dinners where I ate nothing and it was a very awkward experience. Like, I feel like you have to eat something just so other people are comfortable with you not eating.
Yeah. I mean, because, that's the whole social side of it. And, you know, I mean, unless everybody knows what's going on, you know, you just kind of want to blend in.
Right.
So, I don't know. I guess every case is different. But, yeah, you know, I will. And I'll order a salad or, you know, keep it really simple. Or, you know, the other thing is I have called the restaurant ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it's not busy, maybe in the middle of the day, and even spoken to the chef or spoken to a knowledgeable server and, you know, even planned out a meal in advance. So.
Right.
That's also an option.
How strict are you at reading food labels? Because if you technically go by the book, if something has juice from concentrate or natural flavors, you're not supposed to have it. And some people go as far as writing the company and getting a letter before they would even consider trying something.
I mean, like for the first 2 or 3 years, I was extremely strict. I didn't do, like, I only bought, you know, Cento brand tomatoes, and, you know, I didn't buy anything that didn't have a letter, because I was just too afraid of making a mistake. I didn't know for sure that it was that necessary, but I had put so much work into it and so much of an investment, I just didn't want to make a stupid mistake. So I just went with it. And, you know, I was restricted as it was, and I just said, well, you know, one more thing. But now I don't worry about it as much. Like I said, to me, that's, you know, a tiny, tiny thing. I mean, if I can get away with eating, you know, potatoes or, you know, some potato chips, you know, now and then, you know, it's probably going to be okay if there's traces of something that's not on the label for me. Now, I don't want to advocate that for others, but that's how it's been for me.
Right. Do you have any tips for people who are very busy and feel, because I also see patients like this where they have a very busy career, maybe they're traveling all the time, and as far as implementing this diet for someone like that?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, you know, when you are home, you know, making big batches and simple recipes, you know, it doesn't have to be complex. Some of the simplest recipes is just, you know, you can just have ground chicken with salt and pepper and cumin, or, you know, grill a steak, grill, you know, 4 steaks or 10 steaks, right? You know, roast some chicken thighs and, you know, keep it in the freezer. Roasting some butternut squash or, you know, any vegetable that tastes really good when you roast it. Traveling, you know, that's a little bit more difficult, but, you know, you can carry solid food with you on the airplane. So even if you're carrying it solid, one thing I learned along the way is that you can fill up water bottles and freeze them before you leave. And, you know, if you don't live too far from the airport and they're still frozen solid, by the time you go through security, you're using it as an ice pack. Uh-huh. And as long as you point it out to the TSA before you enter, you know, the line, they'll take it aside, and, you know, they might want to swab it, but they'll let that water bottle through as long as it's frozen solid. You know, and I guess you could do the same thing with gel packs, but who wants to be carrying the gel packs on the back end of the trip? So that was a really, really good tip that I had learned early on. But yeah, you know, I mean, I used to always travel with solid food. I mean, very early on, probably like within the first couple of months of doing the diet, I took a trip cross country and I spent a week out in California. And I mean, I packed a huge cooler full of food that I prepared. And, you know, we found some dry ice and we had to get, you know, special, I guess, permission from, you know, the TSA. And, you know, it was a big process to go through, but I carried all my own food. And, you know, I lived off of that for the week that I was out in California. So it wasn't easy, and I wouldn't want to go back to those days. But, you know, it can be done, you know. Like, if you put your mind to it, anything can be done. And then as you get more adept at it, then you start learning how to order out when you're eating out.
Right.
So that helps.
Yeah, I do agree with you that in the beginning, I think the first couple of years, you should be pretty strict, like as strict as possible. But then things tend to open up naturally, and how that opens up for individual people is different. You know, there's some, like, right. You know, we were at this conference and we're around hundreds of people on this diet, and some of the people I met were still extremely strict with it, and they had been on it for years, you know, like 15 years, 20 years. But then there were other people who had started to incorporate different things and not having any adverse effects to it. So, I think eventually you kind of just, it naturally happens. You just kind of figure out when you're comfortable. It's almost this intuition you get. Where now I feel like maybe I can try something and see what happens. Because, you know, if you have an adverse reaction to it, number one, it may not actually be active inflammation. It's probably, most of the time, it's probably just a food you haven't had in a long time and you're eating it and you may just not tolerate it the same way somebody who doesn't have inflammatory bowel disease may not tolerate a food. So it's not smart to always assume that if you're feeling bad, it's due to active inflammation or my disease is coming back. That may not be the case.
Yeah, so, and it could be, you know, with leaky gut, you know, and not partially digested food proteins being kind of poured into the bloodstream and activating the immune system, you know, that really it's just a food sensitivity. And then as that gut heals, that later on you may be able to tolerate that food.
Mm-hmm. Even the concept of leaky gut, I know we hear about it a lot, but there are some gastroenterologists who believe it's a real thing and some people who don't. Like, in the absence of an actual diagnosed GI pathology like celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, etc. Leaky gut in somebody who doesn't have anything like on a biopsy where it looks normal, that itself, just to say that, to play devil's advocate, that there are some people who actually believe that's not a real condition. Okay, so do you have any ideas to improve upon the SCD now, and specifically with regard to organic? Now, are you a believer in that people should go all out on organic food, only eat organic food, or is it okay not to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, it depends on the individual. I mean, for me personally, I like to do organic as much as I can. I do believe that, you know, the vegetables will have a higher nutrient content because the soil, you know, hasn't been killed by overuse of pesticides. And, you know, the fertilizers that are given to produce, you know, are really just enough to keep the plant alive, but don't really contribute to the overall kind of profile of nutrition that plant should offer or that we need, you know, as humans in that plant. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when possible, I do like to buy organic or, you know, go to my, you know, the local farmer's market, but it's, you know, it's not always realistic. And certainly whenever we eat out at restaurants, we're not, you know, and the same is true for the meats. I mean, we know that, you know, when we're eating grass-fed beef or, you know, pasture-raised chickens and, you know, wild-caught, you know, seafood, that they're just so much more nutritious and they're less inflammatory. So I think all of that contributes. So, I mean, you know, the omega-3 level in all of the animal meats and the fish, you know, is just so much higher when they're eating the food that they're supposed to be eating, and then not to mention the antibiotics that they're being given, you know, in conventionally raised animals. So I do try to do it. I totally realize that it's not practical for everyone. It's not practical for me all the time. You know, it is more expensive, definitely more expensive. But I do think that two things I'll say about that. One, I think you're getting more bang for your buck because you're getting a higher nutrient content out of organic foods. And two, I think once you start eating this way overall, you start being less hungry because your cells are being fed. You know, your body's not screaming for nutrition. So, you know, when you're kind of eating the standard American diet, I think people are like hungry all the time because the body's like, oh, I'm still hungry, you know, mm-hmm. I still need nutrition. So, I mean, I've noticed that I'm just not as hungry anymore. I eat plenty of food. I've got a great appetite, but, you know, I just don't feel like my body's screaming for it anymore. So that's kind of my thoughts on organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've also noticed I eat less, and I am aware of some research that, I'm not sure of the exact study, but that there, if you end up eating the same types of things over and over again, you tend to eat less food as opposed to if there was like much more variety. I wonder if that's part of it too. But overall, I think eating less is a good thing, unless you're underweight. But overall, it's probably a good thing for your long-term health. And another thing I wanted to ask you specifically is, I have cooked a lot of salmon over the last decade. That's one mm-hmm. of my go-to meals to if I'm hungry and I just want to make something quickly. But, you know, I know it would be better to eat wild-caught salmon, but what I've found is that it's more difficult to cook properly. The farm-raised salmon, and I tend to go to Whole Foods to get this stuff, the farm-raised salmon, it first of all, I feel like it tastes better. It's fattier. And it's easier to cook because it doesn't dry out easily and it doesn't form that like white albumin film. Mm-hmm. But the wild caught does, it forms that very quickly and it tends to get really dry and tough. Do you have any tips? Do you make much salmon yourself?
You know, it's funny because I never ate seafood before. I had a very bad diet before all of this. So I guess once I started eating salmon and other types of fish, it was more because I knew it would be good for me. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of jumped to eating you know, the wild caught. So I don't know. I haven't had that experience of, you know, comparing one to another, but that's interesting to hear about.
Okay. Yeah, I've probably made salmon like over 1,000 times, maybe even more. I mean, it's just, that's just my go-to thing because I actually live on a grocery store. I live in an apartment building where my lobby is a Whole Foods. Right. So, and I did that intentionally because a lot of times I don't have time to cook or do meal prep. So I'll just get some sort of seafood and just grill it real quick and get some vegetables and eat it. And Whole Foods does tend to have some ready-made things that probably are legal, like the rotisserie chicken, or they'll have like grilled vegetables, and they usually list all the ingredients they use.
Yeah.
So you can survive. It's not that great tasting. I actually think the food at Whole Foods that's ready made doesn't taste good at all. It's like pretty bland, but if you're in survival mode, you'll do what it takes just to keep going. Okay, so as of right now, is SCD really the only thing you're utilizing, or this kind of partial SCD, or are you using any other kind of alternative treatments to help you with your remission?
No, I mean, really, the diet. I mean, I'm exercising again, and I've been really trying to concentrate on keeping my stress down. I really have kind of come to understand that that's a huge factor. So, you know, I go to yoga a lot. I breathe, you know, I try to remember to breathe, and I try to put things into perspective. And, you know, sometimes life is really hard and, you know, things come your way and things that you don't expect, and you just have to figure out how to deal with it. But, you know, you really have to address this stuff. It's really important to not just bury it. So it's just something I've been working on, you know, more and more, and just trying to release control over certain things. You know, I'm kind of in the process of realizing is, like, you know, rather than being a control freak, it's actually quite liberating to let go of control and just kind of like let things unfold the way, you know, the universe kind of has it planned. So I think that's a big thing. I would say that, you know, stress is a really, really important thing to control. So when people say that they're doing SCD and they're not seeing results, you know, I always think, you know, maybe they need to look a little bit deeper. So, you know, maybe it's time to do some stool testing and see if, you know, there's some kind of infection or, you know, a parasite, or, you know, let's look at stress levels and, you know, look at, you know, what the adrenal system is looking like. You know, there are lots of different factors to look at. So, I mean, it's not 100% about diet. It's a really, really important foundation, piece of the foundation, but there's more, you know, there's more to it. So that's what I would say. No, I'm not using, you know, I take supplements, I take multivitamins, fish oil, and that kind of thing. But other than that, that's what I'm doing.
So again, just to play devil's advocate, and I totally respect your opinion, and I actually agree, because I do think stress plays a part, but the official answer from, you know, Western medicine, gastroenterology, is that stress doesn't cause inflammatory bowel disease. There's overall, the consensus is that there's pretty much conflicting data on if stress contributes to flares or if it doesn't. A lot of the studies were not done with hard outcome measures, like more based on symptoms, so it's hard to tell if stress really plays a part. But there tends to be the opinion that at the very least, we don't think it causes it. My personal opinion is I've just heard too many stories of people being diagnosed during very stressful periods of their life.
Right.
That I think if it's not directly related, it could be indirectly, because the stress could be leading you to do things, maybe eat poorly, maybe not go outside, not get enough sun, maybe your sleep is poor. So maybe indirectly it could cause it. It's tough. It's a tough question to answer.
I'll add to that, you know, like I think stress, you know, we know it causes like a number of physiological changes in your body, and it's, you know, just that natural fight or flight response and, you know, the maintenance that has to happen after that. And so, you know, your cortisol levels are rising, and like, we know that that has the effect like all of the things that are changing in your body has the effect of shutting down or, you know, suppressing kind of secondary systems in the body. So, I mean, you know, they talk about how in order for you to be able to run away from the tiger, you know, your first priority isn't on digestion or reproduction. So, you know, stomach acid production gets suppressed and motility gets suppressed. And so then with that comes poor digestion of food and, you know, perhaps the overgrowth of bacteria and, you know, and then what that leads to, you know, as the bacteria are releasing, you know, gases and so on and so forth and creating inflammation. So you can see, yeah, like an indirect path in that example.
And it's ironic that we feel like maybe stress could be a contributor, but then we give people prednisone. Prednisone is kind of like artificial stress in a pill. And that, so in like the short term, it can bring things under control. But in the long term, obviously stress or prednisone is a terrible thing. So, okay, so I think we're coming up on our time limit here. Try to keep these under an hour just for both of our sake so we can get on with our days. But can you, just to close here, and again, thank you so much for coming on. And I think your story is very inspiring for people who are are just being diagnosed or just considering diet to hear from someone who's had success the traditional way. It's just good to hear from people who use the diet successfully and are on the other side and can tell us, you know, how it actually is and what to maybe expect in the future for people who have a good response initially.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you could just tell us about what your organization, the Cola Kitchen, right? What that offers and what services are provided.
Yeah, I mean, I like to walk with clients and, you know, hold their hand through whatever kind of dietary and lifestyle changes they may need. You know, it doesn't have to be ulcerative colitis, or it could be, you know, IBS or candida or arthritis, just whatever, you know, kind of chronic issues. So like, on one end, it's like the holistic nutrition consulting, trying to dig for clues about, you know, what may be behind your own individual chronic health issues, and then to work closely together towards any diet and lifestyle changes that could help, but, you know, really meeting you where you are and deciding together what would realistically work for you in your life and, you know, what you may be ready for. And that might involve some motivational work and identifying obstacles and, you know, building strategies to overcome them. And then on the other end, it's just, you know, practical support like meal planning and, you know, finding and building the right recipes or, you know, cleaning out your pantry or, you know, getting into the kitchen and cooking together and, you know, showing you how to make a dish or simply, you know, discussion and answering any of the random questions that may come up about food, because it's, you know, it's really kind of become this complex topic with a lot of different opinions coming from different directions. So just, you know, help in just sorting all that stuff out, whatever it may be.
And how can they find you on the internet?
So I have a website. It's www.colokitchen.com, C-O-L-O-K-I-T-C-H-E-N.
And then if do you want to give out any your email address or any contact information?
It's just colokitchen@gmail.com.
Okay.
And I'm in Northern Virginia.
Northern Virginia. Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again for coming on.
Yeah. It's been terrific. I really appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me to this. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks.